115 of you who haven't picked up your exams yet, they're available outside of my office. It actually is pretty important that you pick it up and you look at it pretty carefully to see the kind of things you miss. It's a very good opportunity for you to figure out the kinds of things that are working well and not working well. I mean, by that I mean, if you look and you see you're losing lots of little points from silly mistakes, that's one thing. If you look and you're doing okay on some things and absolutely zeroing out on others, that tells you something very different about how you should be studying or what you should change when you're studying. So it's a good opportunity to, it's an essential opportunity actually to go through and figure out what's going on. So the best way that you can adjust things. I do have a number of regrades that I'm working on. I don't worry about turning that around super fast because more of them are coming in. But I will email people when I get to the bottom of the stack and let you know that they're available. But you'll have to come by and pick them up. I'll try to bring them to class and can pick them up after class or something. But I can't put them out in a box anymore. I do have a request for you. I mean, I'm pretty liberal about regrades. I'm happy to look at it. It's essential to me that we try to grade you as fairly as possible. And if you have looked carefully at your own tests, you'll realize there's a lot of detail. And it's very hard to grade everything perfectly. I really do ask, though, that before you request a regrade and basically waste my time, I would like you to make sure you understand the problem and the solution and what you did. I do have some in the stack that are really frivolous regrades that more or less point out the fact that, yeah, you really, really don't understand the problem. So you do want to understand what you did and what the solution is before you actually can ask for the regrade, right? Because there has to be some degree of unfairness there. So I ask that you respect me that much. Otherwise, I'll have to change my regrade policy if I get a lot of frivolous requests. So that said, any questions, issues post-exam that you want to bring up here? Okay, I don't know if I mentioned it. Did I say something about the troubleshooting guide? No, okay. If you go to the class website, I won't bother bringing it up here. If you look on the class website, there'll be something called the troubleshooting guide. And when you go to that, I looked at it the other day, I'm a little embarrassed. It's quite out of date in terms of, I wrote that at a time when I taught the class a couple of times and I was constantly getting asked the same sets of questions about things. So I made this troubleshooting guide to try to answer all those questions. And when I looked at it the other day, I realized that the whole way in which we're running the class is really quite different from how it used to be. So that there are, you know, how we assign workshop sections and things like that are just, it's done totally differently. So when you glance at it, at the higher level, you'll find a lot of it just completely irrelevant for you. But if you go to the one that says you didn't get the grade you wanted on the exam, and you go to that, a lot of that advice is really similar. It's basically my way of giving you some idea of what may have gone right or wrong on your test, and from that, what you might want to think about. So something to maybe look into if you feel the need. So anything else about that? Yes?
Is there a deadline for regrade?
Yes. I would like to have them at least a few days before the final exam. Well, I mean, what I really mean by that is I just want it to be right. Okay, but I need to have that settled before I make up the final scores. Really, if you're not looking at that exam now and handing a regrade if you have issues with it, then you're really, I mean, I think you're missing out, because now is the time you need to look at it, and if it requires some changes, then you need to do it. However, I will tell you that it isn't that crazy. It does happen that when students are preparing for the final, they're looking at their old tests and they actually catch legitimate things. And I will fix it. So, okay. It's not really an invitation for everybody to just dump all their exams on me 2 days before the final. I won't be happy then. So I would ask that you, you know. But I'm not going to slam the door shut on that until pretty much I'm evaluating the final grades. And I don't actually slam the door shut then either. If you really do find a problem and you come in later and, you know, I agree with you, then I'll change the grade. Okay. So last time we were talking about work and energy, and we've defined work in this just ridiculous looking way, where it's the integral over the path length or over the path length, where I'm using the generic variable for path length, ds or s, and then a differential element along that would be ds. And we're talking about something that may be moving, so in the direction that it's going in form of vector, the little displacement vector, ds. And for each little moment of time where it may have moved a differential ds, there is an amount of work, which is a differential dw, the little tiny bit of work, which is equal to the force at that point. And I don't worry whether the force is changing in magnitude or anything with time, because it's only happening over this differential little time, this differential little moment. Okay, so sort of by definition, over that moment, because it's so small, it's constant, which is why you do calculus. That's why you do these little differentials. So in that little ds, the little differential work is f dotted into ds, okay, where this dot is basically a vector multiplication where you take one vector and another vector and you put them tail to tail and there's an angle between them. And the dot product then is a scalar, it's a number that is the magnitude of one times the magnitude of the other times the cosine of the angle. If you look at this, this is really the magnitude of one times the projection of the other one along the first one. Or the other way around. You can think of it as this one, magnitude of this one multiplied by the projection of the D on the A. So either way, you sort of get in that cosine theta. So that's really what it does. And another way to evaluate it, you may find useful if you have the components of the vectors, is this subdivision problem. If you ask what is the finite force, if I go from some point I to some point F, then you want to sum up all the little differential works along the way. And when you do that, you have the integral of F dot ds. Okay. And there are times when things are changing in such a way that you really do have to do the integral. So this is a general form. Very often, probably the vast majority of the things you'll look at, it will break into obvious sections. So we did an example last time where we carried a backpack up a cliff and then over and then down a cliff. And each of those three stages, the relative orientation of the displacement vector and the force were constant during those periods. So the integral really just broke into a sum of three separate finite problems. And so that's sort of probably what you'll see more often than not. So isn't too often you'll have to pull out this form, but you want to keep in mind what it really is. Another thing we talked about was the form of energy that you get if things are moving. And we derived an example where we saw that the amount of energy you would get when you drop something was 1/2 mv². So we define something called the kinetic energy of motion, which is of the form 1/2 mv². So we'll talk a lot about energy conservation and different forms of energy, but in the example where we climbed the cliff, we were carrying a backpack, and we asked, what is the work that we did on the backpack? And it's basically the force that we exert on the backpack times the distance that we go up. And that force is equal to mg if you're not accelerating, because there's always gravity pulling down. So if you're going to keep it from falling against gravity, you're having to exert upward force. So I can sort of do the same thing here. And I can do some work and lift this chunk of metal, I guess it's steel, up high. So I do work by pulling on this string, which exerts a force on this mass, which had gravity pushing, pulling down. So in order to sort of bring it up, if we don't worry about acceleration, but let's say it accelerates in a constant way, then I will do mg, or that's the mass of this image, mg times h worth of work in order. So I imbued it with that much energy, and if I let it go, then gravity is doing work on it. And as gravity does work on it, it converts the energy into energy of motion. So at the bottom here, if I were to define H as zero at this point, the gravitational potential energy, the amount of energy that I had stored in it, is now zero, but it's moving very fast, because from one-dimensional kinematics equations, you know, you can calculate how fast something is moving after it falls a certain distance. And how do I know kinetic energy of motion is actually energy? Because at this point, it has the ability to do work. It has the ability to do work because it can, this object can exert a force through a distance by virtue of its motion. So when it hits the nail, it's clearly exerting a force through a distance to slam the nail down into the wood. So it can do work. So, I don't know. A lot of the whole work energy thing is sort of common sense. You just have to keep in mind what I call energy flow. You sort of have to think about what's happening. I put energy into the system, it's now potential energy. That energy then changes into kinetic energy, which then uses its energy to slam the nail. So these problems sort of, you can think about them that way. So I want to do this. So just to remind you, you know, in this example, if I have this object, which is at a distance h up high, I know if it falls that distance h before it hits the nail, for example, that it will move at speed, d squared is equal to v0 squared, plus 2 times acceleration times h. The acceleration, I'll let it be positive down. V0 is going to be 0. The acceleration is 9.8 meters per second squared. But we'll just call it g. So V0 squared is 0. So V squared is equal to 2gh. Or this is how we get the fact that... If I multiply by 1/2 times m, so we look at this as the potential energy stored initially, and then this is the kinetic energy when the potential energy has gone away, when you drop it, right? So the calculation really is one where I'm asking, if I have a certain amount of energy stored at the top and I now let it go, you can use the kinematics equation to calculate how fast it's going at the bottom. And then when you do that, you get this number, or this equation. And in terms of energy, this is equivalent to saying that the potential energy I had up at the top is equal to the kinetic energy I have at the bottom. So you can think of the energy as basically flowing from one point to another. Okay, so let me do a little example. Want kids someday? Personal question. There's at least two of you. Hopefully a few more. Kids are amazing and fun. If you really knew what it took beforehand, you probably would never have them. But fortunately, most of us are oblivious to the reality of that. And then when you have them, the first time you see them, this amazing biological transformation. I'll never forget it. I mean, it's a sobering moment. I think my daughter, Allison, some of you may know her, she had been home only, you know, a day or something. And I remember I was holding her in the couch, oblivious, you know, very tired and everything, but it was really wonderful. And at that age, parents are just all about this kid, but they really look a little bit like Winston Churchill. And they really don't do anything except sort of sleep and burp up, but, you know, they're really the greatest. So you're all about it. And I remember that moment. I thought, wow, I would totally jump in front of the bus to push this kid out of the way. And so it's a really weird moment when you realize it isn't about you anymore. It's about the kid. And it is truly amazing. So anyway, the other really great thing about kids is they're really a lot of fun to mess with. It's really a lot of fun. My kids are up to their elbows when they were really little and carving pumpkins. And I made some little remark about, oh, did you hear about the pumpkin worms? And we were living in Haven at the time, you know, in Hartford. And both kids sort of looked at me a little bit. I was like, yeah, they've been known to, you know, take off fingers. And at this point, they both got, you know, full attention. It's like, really? Not really, right? Well, maybe. Anyway, so let's suppose that that you really are sick and tired of your kid, and you go to a playground, and there are three slides in the playground, okay? And somebody has really not been very good about this construction of the playground, and each slide has a brick wall. Basically at the end, okay? And the question really is, your kid's gonna run and go down one of these slides, and which slide would you least want them to go down? If that makes any sense. Either A, B, C, or it actually just doesn't matter.
Because you don't actually care.
No, I don't mean that. And we're in a frictionless world, so these are really good slides. Okay. All right. So the one you would least like the child to go down. So all of you think A, B, C, D. Okay. So some of you just don't care. All right. Okay, I sort of left out an essential point, which is they all have the same height. Is that not obvious? Sorry. So MGH, that is the potential energy at the top, is the same for each one. and that's equal to 1/2 mv squared if they drop down that distance h. Okay? So there's nothing in here about the way in which they do it. We call it a conservative force in that the energy stored in the system only depends on the endpoints. And that's the way gravity is. It doesn't actually matter whether you go like this or you go straight down. The change in your energy is the same. So in the world where you have no friction, your velocity at the bottom is going to be the same in all three cases. It's a little stunning, actually. Whether your kid's going down this nice slide like this, or whether you take them over the edge and drop them. Same velocity at the bottom. In reality, it's not really that way, because friction exists in the sliding door. So clearly, you would want them to go down A in reality, whether you have a world of friction. But we're going to talk more about that as we go. So what we've been seeing is sort of this manifestation of energy conservation. You've probably heard of that before. Physicists are all about conservation laws. So energy conservation really says that in an isolated system, the sum of the initial energies for whatever types of energy you have in the system is constant. The sum of the energies is a constant. Or the sum of the energies is equal to, at the initial time, is equal to the sum of the energies in the final time, although they may change their form. Right, so you have that case with the kid and the sliding board. When they're at the top of the sliding board, we say they have an energy, which is we call potential energy. And when they're at the bottom, it's in the form of kinetic energy. Okay? If you have friction, the reason you go slower at the bottom is you have a start with a certain amount of energy, and as you go down, you have this additional force. You exert a force times the distance, which means you are losing energy to friction as you go down. So when you get to the bottom, you've used up some of that energy, and your velocity is going to be less for that reason. All right, so do you believe this? Anybody believe in energy conservation? Come on.
Do you believe?
I want to know. I want to see. I want to feel it. Does somebody here feel it? Who really believes? I need a real believer here. I'm not telling you. All right. We're gonna see just how much you really believe in it. We need you to stand right here. Turn around. Back up about 2 feet. No, oh, okay, forward just a little bit. A little bit more. Okay, turn around. Alright. Now, what I want you to do is to hold this, okay? And let it go, and then stand still. Don't move forward yet. Okay. Thank you. So in case any of you have an inferiority complex where Yale kids are concerned, I once gave this lecture at Yale, and I had a student come up. And the student came up, and I said, okay, let it go, and push. And it took a moment for me to process this. I was sort of standing there, and it just totally caught me off guard. I mean, now I didn't look for it, but I didn't. It's the first time I've ever done it. And I realize as this thing starts swinging back, that the student pushed it. And I was just like, holy crap. Right where that head was. Yeah, so you know. You're smarter than your average Yale student, for sure. So, anyway. So, why was I not worried? Right, it's all energy conservation. We lift the thing up, you've got MGH worth of energy, if you define zero at the bottom or whatever. You just let it go. That gets transformed into kinetic energy at the bottom. Goes up to the other side, potential energy comes back, and there's no other source of energy. So as it converts the kinetic energy back into potential energy, it's going to go to exactly the same height that it started from. In fact, in reality, it doesn't go quite that high because you've lost a little bit of energy to friction and to sort of air resistance on the cable and things like that. So it won't go quite as high. But it really does scare the crap out of it. It does. So, all right. So, maybe... I want to think how worth our time it is doing this one. I'm going to go through this fast with an example of slides I already have. It's really not, we've sort of seen the pieces of it, so it's not really worth my time to step through it really slowly. And this will be available on the web, but let me... it's nicely invisible. Okay. First person who snores out loud gets 10 points off exam one. So, okay. So this is the problem. We have H1 here, and I guess the question is how high does it go on the other side? And if we just release it from rest, okay, then it's going to move, it's going to have a velocity at the bottom. If we define the zero for the height to be here, right where the bottom of the ball reaches at the bottom. Then at any given time, we have only really two sources of energy. One is the kinetic energy and the potential energy. The potential energy is given by this mg times h above the zero, and the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². And basically, in this problem, that's a constant. So at the top, the total energy, the velocity is zero, and the total energy is just mg times h1. And then as it goes down, here, the potential energy is zero, so you now have zero here, and the total energy is just going to be equal to 1/2 mv². And you can ask, for example, how fast is it going? And when... at y equals zero, this 1/2 mv² is going to be equal to the total energy you started with, because remember, you started with V is equal to zero. The total energy is mg h1. So you can solve for the energy, which is just this square root of 2gh1. Now, one of the things that, one of the reasons that we do energy analysis is that it's very often easier to do than the kinematics equations that you're used to. And in this case, the kinematic equations maybe aren't so obvious because you're moving, in a sense, down this way. But if you ask, it's hard to do this problem. When you just drop a book, you can use the 1D energy equation, 1D kinematics very easily. But here, the motion is a bit more complex, and the energy works. One of the things that you'll find, though, is sometimes it's quite easy to solve the problem both ways. And they're both right. There's not a right way or a wrong way to do it. These are just different ways of looking at a particular physical problem. And sometimes the 1D kinetics equations work, and sometimes it's best to solve 1D kinematics equations, and sometimes best to use energy conservation. So as it goes up to the other side, though, your velocity is zero on the other side, so the kinetic energy term on FMV squared is zero. If the energy has been constant the whole time, then you know it has to have a potential energy term, which is equal to what you have on the other side. Which means you go to MgH2, and H2 has to be equal to H1, because otherwise the kinetic energy wouldn't be zero. If that makes any sense. So, I don't know if it's really worth our time going through this. Okay. Now, I want to sort of show you a little something, because those of you who are sort of in the mode of reading the book and trying to find an equation that you can memorize to plug things in, I guess this is sort of the equation that you want to use. What it basically says is that the change in the total energy of the system is equal to the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy. In the case that you have something which is called a conservative system, really all you have is the potential energy and the kinetic energy, and that energy flows from one to the other. And there is no sort of external energy bleeding out or feeding in. And that means that this thing is zero. This WNC stands for non-conservative work. Think of that as friction or something like that. So in a system where I have this ball going back and forth, and when it hits the bottom, it's actually dragging a bit along sandpaper, you're going to lose some amount of energy due to the sandpaper, and when it gets up to the other side, it won't rise as far. Okay? That would be a non-conservative system, because basically it means energy is conserved, but it is conserved in such a way that I really can't track it very well, so the energy doesn't really flow from the potential to the kinetic energy, because I've got this non-conservative strange stuff happening in the middle of it. So if you have conservative force, then this is zero, and basically it tells you that the change in the kinetic energy is equal to the plus the change in potential energy is zero. So that basically says that energy is always the same, it's just a constant. The problem that I have with actually trying to use an equation like this, you'll find a similar thing in your book, is that when you start worrying about changes, you have to worry about the signs, which is getting bigger, which is getting smaller. And I find that whenever I try to just sort of rely on the formula and fit things into the formula, I fall flat on my face, dropping a sign somewhere. Or I find it actually very confusing. Your book will probably present it using this sort of form. You'll probably see examples where they break it down in this way a bit. And I'm fine if you want to do that. My advice is that you actually just go with the flow of the problem, which is you sort of think about where the energy is going in order to analyze the problem. You start out with some energy. I lift the ball up. It's up this high. What energy do I have? I have a certain amount of potential energy. I let it go. Where does the energy go? The energy, this is what I start with. That has to be equal to wherever it goes. Okay? It goes into the kinetic energy. It goes into the potential energy that comes back over on the other side. If you've lost energy to do some non-conservative force over here, then the total energy you start with turns into the energy due to this non-conservative force plus the potential energy you ended up with, or something like that. So you sort of think about where the energy goes. And it's sort of hard to write down just a little equation that encapsulates that. But intuitively, if you sort of follow the energy, then I find that these energy problems tend to be pretty simple done that way. So that's sort of how I like to do it. But I did want to at least show this to you so you've seen it. Okay. So maybe I'll slow down and do this one myself. So to give you a sense of what I mean, let's imagine that we have a situation where I have an inclined plane with a block on it, and we'll say that that block is at a height d. And let's say that the inclined plane is frictionless. And then the block comes down, and don't worry about the, the fact that weird things will happen right here. Assume it moves smoothly, and it comes down, and it slides on the floor, say, from this point, some distance x. And we're going to say that on the floor region, from this point on along the floor, you have a coefficient of kinetic friction, mu sub k. All right? And then the question is, how big is x when the block stops? Or how far does it go on the floor once it gets to this point, okay, relative to that point? So, here's how I think about it. I mean, I don't go to that equation. I just think about what's happening. The total energy I start with is mg times d. That is mg times the height. Okay, so that's the potential energy I think. I let it go. Okay. As I let it go, it gains kinetic energy and loses potential energy. So I now have a non-zero velocity here. So it's moving. I can calculate the speed at the bottom, which will be 1/2 mv squared is equal to mgd. Right. And then the block will be sliding with that velocity. It now has an unchanged potential energy as it slides along here. Where does the energy go? The energy goes into friction because I have a frictional force that it's sliding against. That doesn't work because it goes against that force over a distance. That energy actually turns into heat, which if you rub your hands together, you can sort of feel it gets warm. So that's where the energy actually goes. We know the size of the force, so if we know the velocity we start with and the size of the force, we can figure out how far it goes if you assume that the kinetic energy all gets transformed into the frictional energy. So let's just look at that more closely. So the energy that you start with is going to be equal to mg times d. And at the bottom, then we know that mg times d is equal to the 1/2 mv squared because, or how do I say this? Plus kinetic energy, which is equal to zero. Let me do that carefully. This is the potential energy. The kinetic energy at this point is equal to zero because it's 1/2 mv squared and v is equal to zero at the top. Right? So now I let it go. At the bottom, so So I'm going to call that right here. I'll call this the bottom. At the bottom of the inclined plane, E is equal to the kinetic energy plus its potential energy. So it's going to be equal to the 1/2 mv squared that it has at the bottom plus mg times the height at the bottom, which I'm going to define as 0. So I'll call this... Then as it travels, the energy that you begin with at the start, this is E bottom, as it travels like this, it starts with a velocity, it'll go to some B prime, and it's moving, it's got a frictional force, which opposes its motion, which is equal to the normal force times mu sub k, or mg times mu sub k. So, if you ask, what is its total energy at some point here, or what happens to the energy you start with, where does it go? The energy goes into... the changing potential energy of the mass, but it's not changing because it's not changing in height. So this is 0. Plus the changing kinetic energy of the mass. And this is changing. So you go from some 1/2 mv squared goes to 1/2 mv prime squared, whatever velocity it has at that point. Plus... I guess what we had called work non-conservative in that other equation, or in this case, I think of this as the energy lost to friction. Or you might think of it as the work done on the object by friction. So this piece is going to be the force of friction times the distance you go. So if I go some distance x here, this piece is going to be equal to mg times mu sub k times the x. Okay? So, in this problem, what I'm asking is how far does it actually go all the way where it stops? When it stops, there's been no change in potential energy, so that term's 0. There's no change in the kinetic energy is now 0 because, by definition, when it stops, it has no kinetic energy. Which means... at the point it stops, all of its energy has been transformed into this frictional loss of energy. It's been transformed into heat energy basically by friction. So, at the point of this problem, the way to solve it is this is zero, that's zero, and this term is equal to the energy loss due to friction at that point, which is the force of friction times the distance it's gone. So you get that a way to think about it is I start out with this mgd worth of energy. And by the time I get over here, that mgd worth of energy has been transformed into the frictional energy, so it's mu sub k times mg times the x that you go.
So mg times d is equal to mu k times mg times x. And that allows you to solve for x. So x is equal to d over mu sub k. Mu sub k is a unitless thing, so the units are good. Did that work for you? Do you have questions? Did I make it too complicated? Or but you see what I'm doing? I sort of follow where the energy goes. That's how I like to think about these problems. Any questions? All right. I have another pendulum here. All right. And in this case, I'm going to lift the pendulum up to a certain height, and I'm going to let it go. All right. And it's going to come here, and the string is going to hit right here. So when it does, this thing's going to wrap around. So then the question in my mind is, what's it going to do? Is it going to do that? Or is it going to do this? Or what? What do you think? How many of you think it's going to wrap around something? How many of you think it's going to stop right here? How many of you aren't too sure? Okay. Comes up to the same level, and it doesn't actually matter that the problem changed right in the middle, right? Because it hasn't got the energy to go any higher. Even though the string is shorter, it has a certain speed at the bottom, and there's only so much energy. And that energy is only sufficient to give you a change in the potential energy that's equal to basically what you started with. Okay? It will come back up to about the same height because we don't have much in the way of loss of energy to other things. So it ought to come up. And if we did it in a vacuum and had no loss of energy to friction or whatever, you know, it would come up to exactly the same height, regardless of the fact that the string is now shorter. Okay? So energy is a very powerful constraint on a lot of these types of problems. So we do a lot of problems with gravitation, as you've seen, and I'm going to come back to gravity, and we're going to begin to treat it differently. We've only looked at it basically at the surface of the Earth, and it's very relevant there because we want to understand how things change as we have small changes in height. And we do have changes in energy when we do that. It takes work to get something up high that can use it with some energy, and if it has energy, then it can do other things. So things that happen near the surface of the Earth are really important to us. That said, gravity is actually one of the fundamental forces of nature, and it does things besides just stuff here at the surface of the Earth. And so I'm going to spend some time talking about gravity. We'll come back to it and look at it in a more general way, I think, rather than just at the surface of the Earth. That said, I want to actually continue talking about work and energy before we go off and talk more about gravity. And partly why I tell you this is because I think Jean Goley does it in a different order. So I think they have an energy a gravity chapter before they do work and energy, or somewhere in the middle of it. But I'm going to avoid that for the moment. And I want to start talking a bit about another system that turns out to be conservative to a large degree. And when I say that, remember, when I say it's a conservative system, it really means it is something that we can understand the flow of the energy without that energy being lost to something that can't easily quantify, like friction or something like that. And it turns out that a simple spring is a very conservative system. So let's imagine that that we have a frictionless floor, and we have a ball attached to a spring. And it turns out that that you know a lot about springs from just messing with them a little bit as a kid, right? What do we know about springs? If I have a spring, let's say that I have a spring that if I lay it here, I have it connected right here, and I lay it down and it's sitting here. If I grab it and I stretch it, it pulls back, right? As I stretch it more, it pulls back more. It has a stronger force, okay? So one of the things about springs is that the force of the spring that opposes you, what you're trying to do, if you're trying to stretch it, for example, is proportional to the length that you stretch it. If it's a stout spring, so think of, you know, maybe a thick shock absorbing type of spring, then the same is true if you push on it. It pushes back. And if you compress it further, it pushes back even more. Again, the degree to which it pushes back is proportional to the distance. Okay? And that's really the essence of a spring. So if I have this spring just sitting here, I have a frictionless floor, if it's not exerting a force on the ball, then we say that the spring is at its natural length. That's where it's happy to just sit there and not exert a force on anything. If I now stretch it a bit, so I'll call this x0 and this x. So if I now stretch it out a certain distance, there will be a force on this ball due to the spring. And it will be proportional to this distance, x minus x0. Okay? If the spring is a little weak spring, then that proportionality will not be, then it'll be a small force. If it's a really, really thick spring, like you might have on a car wheel or something, then it's going to really have a tremendous force if you pull it out of distance x. So we can get rid of the proportionality by putting in a constant K. Do I want a big K or a little K? I think it's usually a little K. And in physics, it's little known, but there's a great deal of literary creativity in physics. So we call this constant the spring constant. All right. And it is what characterizes the strength of the spring. If it's a stiff spring, this is a big number. If it's a very weak spring, this is a little number. So that quantifies the magnitude of the force. But we have more than that. We have to worry about direction. Because if I pull it out this way, the spring force is to pull it back. If I push it in, the spring force pushes me back. And we say that's a restoring force. And we can actually take it into account by turning this equation into a vector equation. This is now a vector, so if I take the vector from 0, so this would be vector x0 displacement, and this would be vector x displacement. So it's a vector going from the origin now. Okay. So this vector minus that vector sorry, I dropped a very important piece. So you can transform these vectors at the top, but I have this vector which is x0, and I have this vector which is x minus x0 is equal to a vector that's about, well, it's this, right? That's that vector. So it's a positive vector going out that way. I've stretched the ball this way. The force that the spring exerts is proportional to the size of that vector, x minus x0, and it's in the opposite direction. So I can flip the direction of the force by putting the minus sign right here. So the minus sign is what makes it a restoring force. If I compress it instead, then I have something that looks like this, and in that case, this is x0, and x minus x0 gives me something that looks like this, and minus x0 gives me something going in the positive direction, which would be trying to shove this ball back the direction from which I was compressing it. So that minus sign in the vector equation makes it a restoring force. Okay, if I'm pulling this way, it's pulling me back. If I push it in, it's pushing me the other way. Okay? This is another one of those cases where if you really get strung out using equations all the time, you know, this is really the fundamental equation. All the information is there, but you often won't see it that way. Sometimes you'll see it like this. So you sort of define x0 to be 0. Okay? Sometimes you'll see it like this. And this is strictly not actually true. In the sense that this really is a magnitude equation. And when you throw in this minus sign, you're really talking about direction. So it's a little bit strictly, this is a little bit of shorthand. But you'll sort of see it written all these ways. And my advice, again, is to sort of not get too hung up trying to fit everything into the formal vector equation because you like equations.
but to actually think about what's going on in the problem. If it says if spring gets compressed, you know the force of the spring is that way, and you know it is proportional to the distance that it got compressed times K. That's it. So the direction you just sort of can know from how the problem is set up, and then you put it in accordingly and use it that way. If you start subtracting vectors and things like that all the time, you're going to find yourself getting confused. Well, no, you may not, but I will. So bear that in mind.
I'm sure some of you are sitting there thinking, you know,
it is really beyond me why I'm being forced to sit in here and think about springs. Because I really don't give a shit about springs. And I'm really much more interested in, you know, biochemistry or things like that that are really interesting to me. Okay. I can't say I lay awake at night dreaming of springs.
But let me... One of the things that we've already seen a tiny bit with circular motion, some of these very simple examples turn out to be actually incredibly useful. Okay? So let me take something that might be near and dear to some of your hearts. Like a carbon-hydrogen bond, for example. Right? Some of you are inorganic, I can tell. So what is a chemical bond, right? If I have some positive charge sitting here, and I have some positive charge sitting here, and I have a bunch of negative charge sort of out here, that's an atom, right? And how does this thing work? So I have some sort of diffuse negative charge in here.
I mean, this isn't a course in electromagnetism, but basically for electromagnetism, you know that like charges repel and unlike charges attract. And it goes as the inverse square of the distance, okay? So if I take two charges that are alike and have the distance, they're pushing each other away by a factor of 4 relative to how they start. Okay? So what you have here, if the quantum mechanics and electromagnetism sort of gives you this arrangement, let's look at it for a moment. I have a positive charge here and a positive charge there. They have a certain distance from each other. So there's a certain force with which this is pushing that one away. If I had nothing else there, the bond would fall apart because the nuclei would fly away from one another. There's nothing to stop it. But atoms are nicely arranged to have all this negative charge, this unlike charge, which is sort of diffusely around it, which in a chemical bond is neatly arranged so that the density of it is usually more in the middle here. So this charge may be pushing that charge away, but this charge is basically attracting it. And you have a balance in a chemical bond. If I take this and I push it a little bit closer, now it's going to push this one a little further away, but it's getting attracted even more so by this. How do I say that right? No, if I push this a little bit closer, I now will have less electron density between it. So I've reduced the amount of negative charge here. I'm closer to the positive charge, so it begins to get pushed away. If I pull it out this way, I'll get more negative charge in here. I'm further away from the positive charge, so the negative charge will pull a little bit closer. So you actually have, in a chemical bond, something that is like a restoring force. If they move apart a little bit, they get pulled back together. If they move in a little bit, they get pushed back out. You can actually displace an atom and have the thing oscillate, just like you would if it were a string. Okay? And if you do the quantum, in a system with attractive forces, quantum mechanics actually tells you that can only happen for very particular energies, but atoms do vibrate at very particular energies. If you've done infrared spectroscopy, that's basically transitions between different vibrational states in these atoms. So if you really want to understand the chemical bond, it turns out that a very reasonable starting point is a simple spring. It's really not a bad model for your basic chemical bond. So quantum mechanics complicates things a little bit, but it's not a bad place to start. And it turns out that any system where you have sort of a restoring force, you can describe it for small enough displacements, just like a little spring. So it turns out that this simple example that we're beginning to look at is incredibly useful in doing, you know, real physics and understanding physical chemistry and things like that. It's a really useful starting point for things.
Is something that we call Hooke's law. So you may see it that way. So let's look for a moment at the world where I have a spring, and let's say that the x0 is here, so if I let the spring go, it's only this long. And we'll say that we stretch the spring out a bit. And for generality, let's say we stretch it to x1. And now I stretch it from x1 out to x2. So I would like to ask, what is the work done on the spring to stretch it from x1 to x2.
So initially you might think, why do I care? Alright. When we were looking at gravity and we asked, how much work do I do to lift the book up a distance h, we calculated that to be mgh. And then notice that in all our gravitational problems, if I ask you what is the potential energy of that book at a height h, it's mgh. So when you calculate how much work it takes to sort of move from here to here, you're asking what is the change in potential of the system just due to the change in this position because of this gravitational force that's in play. In other words, we're actually understanding how the energy of the system depends on where you are in relation to the gravitational field. For those surfaces. So in this case, if I want to understand how the energy of the spring is related to how it's stretched, the way to do that is to look at how much work it takes, how much energy it takes me to move the spring from one point to another. Okay? And that will be a measure of, instead of the potential energy stored in the book, as I lift it up, it'll be a measure of the potential energy stored in the spring. right? Because I take a string and I stretch it way out, you know it's got potential energy because if I let it go, it's going to wham, right? So it's got energy stored in it by virtue of its condition, its how much it's been stretched. So that's why if we want to understand energy changes in strings, this is sort of where we start. We calculate how much work it takes to move it from one point to another. So you might say, well, that's easy, right? The total work that it takes to do this is going to be this distance that I go times K. It'll be the distance that I go times the force of the spring, which is equal to K times X2 minus X0. I guess you could think of it that way.
So not be negative K?
The force that I put on it is pulling it out in a positive direction. This is an example of why I don't get too hung up on the using the vector piece of it. You sort of have to think about what you're doing. But there is another big problem here. What is it?
Force isn't constant.
Right, the force is not constant. As I pull it out, see, I wrote this in such a way. This is the total distance that you go from x1 to x2. And then I write that distance times the force, because work is force times distance. This force goes as k times this, well, I wrote x2 minus x0, but truthfully, that force, if I have it pulled out a distance x, whatever it is, that's the force. And as I pull it out further, that force is changing. So I can't use something like this.
I actually have to worry about the fact that the force is changing as I go. So I have to imagine that I have it out at some distance x, and I go out a distance dx like that. In which case, the amount of work it takes to go from that position x to that position x plus dx, dw, is equal to the force at position x, which is k times x minus x naught, times the distance that I go, which is just dx. And if I sum that up over this entire interval, the work becomes from x1 out to x2 of f dot d ds, if you want, dx. Okay, and then I have to worry about this integral with the changing force. So we're going to start out class looking at this problem next time and understand how energy flows and anticipate that eagerly for the next 2 minutes.